Certain information set forth in the podcast may contain forward-looking statements under applicable security laws. These statements are not guarantees of future performance, and undue reliance should not be placed on them. Although forward-looking statements contained in this presentation are based upon what management of the company believes to be reasonable assumptions, there can be no assurance that forward-looking statements will prove to be accurate. LifeSci Advisors and the company undertake no obligation to update forward-looking statements in the podcast should circumstances or management's estimates or opinions change. This podcast is for general information purposes only. It is not an offer or solicitation to buy securities and does not constitute investment advice.
And so I think coming in with a drug that's at least or potentially we believe better than the drugs that are out there and do it at a much lower price point, I think we can not just take some market share away from those that are there already, those two PD-1s, but I think we can substantially grow this market through more patients having access to therapy with paying a lot less money.
Hello, my name is Neil Canavan, and this is Benchtop Bios, a podcast series by LifeSci Partners where we introduce healthcare investors to the people and the pipelines driving the biotech sector forward.
My guest today is James Oliviero. He is the president and CEO of Checkpoint Therapeutics. James, welcome to Benchtop Bios.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, now, as always, I'd like to start off with an elevator pitch for the company we're going to discuss today. So, James, where is Checkpoint headquartered? How long have you been in business, and what sort of business do you do there?
Yep, thanks. So Checkpoint Therapeutics, we were founded in 2015 when we licensed in an antibody program from Dana-Farber and a small molecule from a Chinese company. We're originally based in New York City, but have since moved to the Waltham area outside of Boston, but have also hired throughout the country, given the worldwide events, we took advantage of being able to hire the best talent we could find throughout the country. What we're focused in, you know, big picture elevator pitch, is we develop novel anti-cancer therapies focused on treatments for solid tumor cancers. And we generally look to license these products in, looking for products that have validated targets, targets that have already been established in the world of oncology, as if you hit that target, you should see efficacy. We look for some sort of potential for differentiation as we look to license these products in. And like most companies, we look for drugs that could potentially address very large market opportunities. And so that's what you get with our lead development programs that I'm sure we're going to dig into today.
Yes, we will. A little bit on the de-risking there. That would be excellent. But first, we get to talk about you. Benchtop Bios is all about the people who are leading these investigations in these companies, and James, that would be you. Let's start with just a real basic backgrounder. Where were you born, sir? Where'd you grow up?
Yep, I was born in New York City and grew up in a town called Woodbury on Long Island, so just outside a suburb of New York.
That's weird. I was actually born in Woodbury. Okay, got it. It was probably much more developed when you were born than it was when I was born. But at any rate, so just real quick on the background. So my hero growing up, strangely, was a man named George Burns, who was a comedian. Did you have anybody that when you were a kid, like, I don't know, sports figure, anybody? Did you like, yeah.
Yeah, it was sports. I grew up a tennis player, picking up a racket since 3 years old, playing tennis tournaments since 8 years old, which proceeded all the way through college and becoming an All-American collegiate player. My hero growing up was John McEnroe.
Oh,
you know, his antics were obviously entertaining, but him coming out of New York, the way that he took his sport and put all the effort into it. And I took a lot of watching athletes and how they can concentrate on developing their athletic skills, but also apply that to everything else in life, whether it's school or work. There's just a work ethic that comes along with being an athlete that I always looked up to and strive to become.
All right. So if I track down a couple of your friends from high school and they're used to seeing you in your tennis whites, would they be surprised to hear that you are now the CEO of a biotech company, or would they all go, eh, that figures?
Yeah, I think they always knew that I loved math and science, so I don't think it would be that surprising. They knew I certainly strive for success and to reach the top of being a CEO of a company, I think wouldn't be surprising at all. I'll also note that we weren't wearing all whites because it was the time of Andre Agassi, and he wore a lot of tie-dye. So
cool. Oh, I remember him with his hair and everything. Okay, so You did your undergrad at Emory. This is class of 97. You earned a bachelor's in business administration. I got two questions here. Why business administration? And did you really have any idea what sort of business, or you're just agnostic at the time?
Yeah, so Emory starts off as a liberal arts education. So I did 2 years just learning about different areas I could specialize in. I was always drawn towards businesses, towards mathematical concepts and science. It just made sense that business could be applied to any area that I chose to go into. And Emory had one of the top undergraduate business programs. So I joined that for junior and senior year to come out with a business degree with a specialization in finance. So I just thought it was the right way to give me the background to apply to whatever I wanted to go into after college.
All right. So what you went into right after college was a job as an investment analyst at a company called ING Bearing / Furman Seltz, which is interesting because that's the same year that ING merged with Furman or was acquired. I'm not sure about that. Tell me about landing that first job here in the big city. I mean, was this pretty daunting?
Yeah. So Furman Seltz at that time was a boutique investment bank. So a smaller bank. And after I was there, it was acquired by ING. Just like a lot of investment banks, the smaller regional banks were acquired during the late 90s. I went towards investment banking kind of for the same reason I gravitated towards the business degree. It was just a way of really working hard and getting quite an education within the firm that, again, I could apply to wherever I wanted to go, whether it was still in investment banking or to go into industry to work, 100 hours a week and be exposed to international deals, whether it's financings or M&A. It excited me. I loved the idea of being involved in transactions. And so I gravitated towards a investment banking analyst program to start my career. And as far as New York City, daunting. I mean, it's obviously daunting for anybody to move into New York City for the first time. But growing up just outside of New York City and going to Knicks games and coming into the city, I was certainly well-versed on it and very excited to come back to what I view as home.
Nice. All right, so you stayed at that position for a couple of years, and then you moved on to something closer to what we're talking about now, a company called Access Oncology. This is also in New York, so that's an easy move. You were director of finance there for just under 4 years. Was the move into healthcare deliberate? Was this something you were exposed to at Furman?
Yeah, so I did work on a bunch of healthcare deals at Furman Seltz. I really enjoyed it because of my love for science. Once I started learning about biotech companies that I worked on, it was just really exciting. How I ended up at Access Oncology, which was a startup at the time, it was a very small company. I was employee number 3 at that company, obviously private at the time. It was kind of just opportunistic. It was a vice president from my banking group who had a friend that was starting a company, and he knew I was looking to go into industry. And he said, this is a great opportunity. I'm getting in very early and having a major role at the company as it grew. And so I took advantage. I jumped in, and I've been in biotech and healthcare ever since.
Did this give you the opportunity to wear like multiple hats? I mean, if there's
Absolutely. So the finance, the accounting, that's things that I could do easily from my background and grow. But at the same time, I was in charge of helping with business development, doing human resources stuff as we grew the company, legal. I helped on that. I was involved in every aspect of the company, obviously being, employee number 3 at the start and growing the company into 20 or 30 people by the time we merged into Carex.
So I have to ask, were the investors you encountered in that setting different from the ones you started at Furman? Like, are healthcare investors different?
No, similar investors, but the difference there was Access was a private company. So the private investment, the time it takes, the depth that they go into, and the types of deals that you do are different than a public healthcare investor, which is really more what I did at Furman Seltz, which were the IPOs, the secondary follow-on offerings and such. And that's what I did plenty of after we were a public company, after we merged into Carex.
All right. So 2003, you sign on another financial position. This is the CFO of Carex, as you mentioned. This company specializes in CKD. They later emerged with Akebia, but this is after your time. You were there for a good long time until landing in the corner office at Checkpoint. That's in 2015. So 12 plus years at Carex. What did you learn that gave you an idea like, well, I could run a company? Or did you learn that at Access Oncology?
Yeah, Access was great for learning how to build the company and running a very small company. All of a sudden, we actually took over Carex, which was a public company at the time based in Israel. We took it over, merged them together, and then all of a sudden we're a publicly traded company, NASDAQ. And so we moved Carrick's over into our Access Oncology offices in New York City and ran the portfolio that was joined together going forward in a public entity. So while we had the end-stage renal disease programs that were at Carrick's, we already had a nice portfolio of oncology agents at Access Oncology. So it became both an oncology and a renal portfolio that we developed forward. And again, it was a lot of similar people that we brought over from Access Oncology that were now running Carrick's. And I continued to wear multiple hats and learn as much as I can. I started specializing more and more in the clinical development and the regulatory side of the business, working very closely with the experts in those areas, learning how protocols were written, how development programs were formed. And I started getting more and more in charge of those types of things to the point when I was starting to actually write the protocols, and I ended up writing protocols that led to the approval of the drugs there in phase three. So it really expanded what I was able to do beyond, obviously, finance, accounting, and just being a helpful person in all the other departments, but actually really in charge of clinical and on the regulatory front, being the face of the company in front of the FDA during the NDA review.
Okay, so you take that broad experience and you say, you know what, there's a thing called Checkpoint. How did that come about?
Yeah, so after Auryxia, which is a drug that we got approved at Carrick's, was approved by the US FDA and it was also approved by the EMA, we chose to build commercial and launch it ourselves. We did it pretty effectively. That drug's selling about $175 million a year now. But my love was always clinical development. Carrick's at that time was limited only to Auryxia at that time. It was a commercial story. There was no dictation from the board to really license anything further in at that point. So my interest really moved to where can I get back to what I loved, which was bringing new drugs to market. And so the opportunity arose at Checkpoint Therapeutics, which was a new company, private company at the time that was just formed as a subsidiary of Fortress Biotech. But it was the same people that I worked with originally for Access Oncology and Carrick's. Michael Weiss, who was originally the CEO of Access and became the CEO of Carrick's, was chairman and one of the founders of Checkpoint. And he really held this position saying, this is right for you to come over and do what you do best, which is bring drugs to market, bring them through development and bring them to market, and you can do it again here. And so I jumped at the opportunity.
With something new like this, was part of the appeal you would have a freer hand again to conduct companies as you wished?
Yeah, I think a big appeal was to when you get to do it again, you can try to do it better. You can try to do it smarter. That was part of the strategy that I loved about this company was looking to take a fast follower approach with validated targets to reduce the risk of the clinical program. Because we all know, particularly in oncology, most drugs fail. I would say probably 90% of drugs that are probably in the late preclinical space are going to fail either in phase one or through the clinical development program. So we really felt this was a way that we could accelerate the timeline to bring a new novel drug to market with lowering the risk. And I think that shows very well in cosibelimab, where it stands today, now on the cusp of filing for approval with great data in hand. That should absolutely lead to the approval of this drug. So I'm super excited about that.
All right, so let's go straight ahead with the Checkpoint lead asset that is cosibelimab. We're going to call it Cosi for the remainder of this conversation, just to make it easier for me. This is an anti-PD-L1 antibody. This is currently in two pivotal investigations, one in the setting of metastatic cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma, and the other for localized disease, same tumor type. And the second asset we're also going to discuss later is olaferrtinib. This will be called Ola. And this is a small molecule third generation EGFR inhibitor. This is also in late stage testing. So on to Cosi. As mentioned, this is anti-PD-L1 agent. So the first question is, all right, this is a very lucrative, rather crowded field. What's the differentiator with this asset?
Yep. So while there are multiple anti-PD-1s and anti-PD-L1s approved, they're approved in 25 plus indications. And within the different indications, you might have one, two, or three approved, but it's not as crowded as seven or eight that are approved in the class generally, being your competitors within your labeling indication. So with regard to cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma, there's two approved agents. They're both anti-PD-1s. different from us as an anti-PD-L1. So there's two anti-PD-1s. There's no anti-PD-L1s approved. So we're looking to be the first anti-PD-L1. How our drug is different is the fact that, first off, our drug has an active Fc region of the antibody that the anti-PD-1s, our competitors in this case, don't have. There's reasons they don't have it that make perfect sense and I'm happy to get into. So having this active Fc region means that we have a twofold mechanism of action whereby we don't just unlock the T cell response like a PD-1 or our typical anti-PD-L1 does, but through the active Fc region, we have the potential for ADCC or what's called bringing in natural killer cells, another piece of your immune system to attack what we're binding to, which in our case is the tumor cell. So we don't just unlock T cells to attack the tumor. We also bring in natural killer cells to attack the tumor, a twofold prong of attack that could potentially increase the efficacy of our molecule, not just alone, but particularly also in certain combination settings where these natural killer cells can be focused in on the tumor through our antibody. So it really does differentiate us from all the PD-1s and from all the leading anti-PD-L1s by having this twofold mechanism of action that others don't have. The other differentiation we have is as an anti-PD-L1, which means that we bind to the tumor cell, while the anti-PD-1s that we're going to compete with in CSCC bind to the T cell, the actual immune system, we have better safety than the anti-PD-1s. It's been shown with all the anti-PD-L1s that are approved in other indications that there's better safety with an anti-PD-L1. You have lower rates of treatment-related adverse events, particularly severe or worse adverse events. And so we benefit from having that also improvement on safety to compete with these anti-PD-1s that are out there today in CSCC.
All right. So I got to ask, because I know Dan Chen, who was involved with Atezo. I know Dr. Hanjo did the original PD-1. Why would they have engineered out the Fc portion?
Yep. So first off, with regard to the anti-PD-1s, like Keytruda or Libtayo, they bind to the T cell. The anti-PD-1s bind a PD-1 on the T cell. What you don't want then is to bring in natural killer cells to kill what you're binding to, which is the T cell. So they had to engineer out of the ADCC function, the Fc region. Now, the anti-PD-L1s like us bind to the tumor cell. So you have the potential of allowing that ADCC to happen. What the earliest anti-PD-L1s like durvalumab and atezolizumab did was, I think they just wanted to be conservative. They didn't know what would happen from the safety front of having the active Fc region. They wanted to catch up to Keytruda and Opdivo, the anti-PD-1s that were already approved and ahead of them. And so I think they were just very conservative on that. They wanted to do the exact same thing that the Keytruda does, which is just unlock the T cells. So they deactivated the Fc region and just went forward in their indications with their antibodies. And now it's too late now for them to go back.
Got it. So I want to just one more question, drill down just a bit more on the science. The ADCC, how did you show that you have succeeded in that aspect?
Yeah, so that's something you can easily show preclinically. You take human donor cells and you can compare your antibody's cytotoxicity, your killing effect of your antibody versus a control IgG1 antibody. And what we see is 3 to 4 times the killing ability compared to the control, which is essentially no killing ability. So that's where you see it. You can't easily measure it in humans because you'd have to do tumor biopsies on a cancer patient as they're being treated over and over again. And nobody's going to do that. These patients are sick and it's very trying to get tumor biopsies. So we see it preclinically. We know it exists. It's known that an unmodified IgG1 antibody will have an Fc function and have the potential for ADCC. We see it preclinically. It's there. So to be able to say how much contribution of efficacy comes from the T cells versus the natural killer cells, we can't say it in humans, but we can certainly say, here's our data. Look how good it is. There's something here.
All right. So let's talk about a bit about the unmet need here. Cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. This is a type of skin cancer. The first approvals for all these types of drugs were in skin cancer. Again, is this not a crowded space or why this specific indication?
So there's two approved drugs in the indication. They're both premium priced anti-PD-1s from Big Pharma. So Keytruda from Merck and Libtayo from Regeneron. So they're both priced at about $165,000 per patient per year. All they do is unleash the T cell response and they come with a PD-1 safety profile. So what we bring to the table upon a potential approval is efficacy that's at least as good as what they have. Our numbers may be higher, but we'll just call it comparable because there's no head-to-head studies. So call it comparable efficacy. We have the better safety of an anti-PD-L1. And we're going to do something even beyond that, which is launch at a much lower price point. When you talk about an unmet medical need, even though there's anti-PD-1s available, from our research, PD-1s only have about 40% market share in the U.S. market in the systemic therapy space for treating these patients. They have incredible results, but they're only treating 40% of the eligible patients. So why are so many patients still receiving chemotherapy or chemotherapy plus radiation or even a drug like Erbitux, which none of these drugs show very good efficacy? Some of these patients may be immunocompromised or immunosuppressed. Some of them may be transplant patients and the doctors aren't comfortable, but that doesn't make sense for all 60%. I think there's a lot of patients out there that are delaying therapy because of the price of the drug. They don't want to go into debt. So many cancer patients go into debt because they have to pay 20% coinsurance, the 20% of the price of a biologic drug as a coinsurance. That's an enormous amount of money until they hit their catastrophic cap of their insurance for the year. And so a lot of patients, I think, put off therapy or they choose to just go with the chemo. And so I think coming in with a drug that's at least or potentially, we believe, better than the drugs that are out there and do it at a much lower price point, I think we can not just take some market share away from those that are there already, those two PD-1s, but I think we can substantially grow this market through more patients having access to therapy with paying a lot less money.
You described the market in terms of percentages. What are actual numbers here? How many patients are we looking at?
Yeah, cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma, metastatic and locally advanced together right now, that 40% represents about 16,000 patients a year that are being treated. There's about 40,000 advanced patients, but still a lot of them can probably still be cured with surgery. And obviously, if you can get it surgically removed, that's the way to go. But once it metastasizes, you need a systemic therapy. And so there's about a market of 16,000 being treated today. And again, I think we can grow that with our commercial strategy.
As mentioned, the drug is featured in two trials. The first one I'll ask about is the metastatic setting. This trial has been recently completed, key data being presented at this year's ASCO. James, if you could first briefly describe for me the protocol and then top line the efficacy results for me.
Yep. So cosibelimab, it was invented here in the U.S., but we conducted this study outside of the U.S., but we did it in a smart way. We first filed a U.S. IND to ensure that the U.S. FDA was on board with our protocol in cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma, and we took all their feedback and incorporated it. We did what the FDA wants, which was create essentially a U.S. patient population by going ex-U.S., by primarily enrolling in Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, France, and Spain. We have a little bit of Thailand in there for the Asian piece. So we essentially recreate in a multi-regional design exactly what the FDA views as a gold standard. So the protocol around cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma is designed to be similar to the anti-PD-1s that came before us, a similar size study. 75 patients was the target enrollment in metastatic, and 75 is the target enrollment also for locally advanced. The primary endpoint is the same as what came before us, which is objective response rate or shrinkage of the tumor. And you need to show an objective response rate that's clinically meaningful. In our case, we needed to show a response rate of 36% or higher. And so all this was confirmed with the FDA ahead of time, and we conducted the study again under US IND.
How large of a trial was this?
So to date, among all advanced cancers, we've treated about 250 patients within cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. Metastatic was 75 patients. And we recruited 78. So 75 was the target. We recruited 78. And locally advanced is also recruiting the 75, although we conducted an interim analysis.
I have to ask, why did you go ex-US? Was it a financial reason?
No, even though it is less expensive to conduct a trial ex-US. No, the reason to go ex-US is we were conducting the study while Libtayo was already approved in the United States and well reimbursed. So the enrollment in the US would be slow on patients. So in order to effectively enroll the study quickly and bring in the appropriate patients, we chose to go ex-US.
The second trial is in locally advanced disease. First, tell me, are both trials being run the same way with the ex-US centers?
Yep, it's the same centers. Similar patient population, it's just earlier stage. Again, it's primarily enrolling in Australia, New Zealand, France, and Spain. So the same countries, similar centers, yep.
Okay, in this trial, we've had an interim peek at the data. What sort of encouragements did you see?
So it was actually much more than an interim peek at the data. We went to the FDA ahead of time and said we wanted to run an interim analysis that, if successful, meaning it was clinically meaningful results, we wanted to utilize that interim analysis to file for approval in locally advanced and add it to our metastatic indication in the initial BLA submission. The FDA agreed, told us which patients they wanted us to include, which were all patients that were dosed and had a post-baseline assessment. And so then we proceeded with the interim analysis and obtained clinically meaningful results, which were exciting for us in June.
Right. So you mentioned in the marketing strategy earlier, which is a price point. I'm curious, if physicians are already dealing with several assets that they're comfortable with, what sort of a price differential do you have to propose that you think would bring them in? How low do you have to go?
Yep. So as far as pricing, we've done some market research with consulting firms, payer research. And what we learned in the United States, where the payers look at a 30% discount on a net price basis as meaningful to them in order to allow us to hopefully quickly be put on formulary. And in some cases with certain payers, like the regional players, we could even get some sort of preference for our drug, which would be ideal. So 30% as a minimum. In those payers that we can get something more, some sort of preference, we could go to a deeper discount. I've said publicly, even at a 50% discount in price, we'd have close to 90% gross profit margins, which are perfectly appropriate for a company like us. Maybe big pharma wouldn't like that. They just want to keep raising prices. But for a smaller company, we can have a very good living. I think we could even reach profitability in year two at half the price.
The next lead asset at Checkpoint is olaferrtinib. This is a third generation EGFR inhibitor. So this is the same basic question as Cozy. There are other drugs in this space. So why do you want to compete with the other third generations that are out there?
Yep. Good question. So today there's only one third generation EGFR inhibitor approved worldwide. That's Tagrisso from AstraZeneca. They have essentially a monopoly now on the entire EGFR mutation positive non-small cell lung cancer market. It's the largest selling drug at AstraZeneca, again, called Tagrisso. However, Tagrisso does come with a certain safety associated with it. It has effects on the heart, cardiomyopathy, as well as some QTC prolongation in a certain percentage of patients, as well as interstitial lung disease or scarring of the lungs that occurs in about 4% of their patients, according to their labeling, including experiencing some deaths in their studies from this interstitial lung disease. Overall, about 13% of patients couldn't tolerate Tagrisso and discontinued from their pivotal studies. So there's certainly room for improvement on the safety front. And that's what we've seen with olaferrtinib in our phase one study, and also our partner in Asia that ran studies in China saw in their phase one, which is lower rates of the typical TKI side effects at the potential commercial dose, as well as no cases of QTC prolongation or cardiomyopathy, those effects on the heart, and not one case of interstitial lung disease at the current dose that we are proposing going forward towards commercialization, as well as at higher doses that we've tested. So we just don't see interstitial lung disease that you see with Tagrisso. So that's a positive for potentially competing with Tagrisso in the first line setting, but it's also a positive for the potential of combining olaferrtinib with cosibelimab in later line settings, which is where we're going to be concentrating going forward with the olaferrtinib program.
I'm going to touch on that in just a moment. But first, I'd like to point out to our listeners that both James and I have a cold. James is struggling. I'm full of NyQuil, so he's scratchy and I might pass out. But the show must go on. So yes. James, all right. So as with Cozy, you get two trials underway here with this asset. The first one I'll ask about is the phase three trial. This is OLA with first line single agent EGFR mutated non-small cell. This is being conducted by your partner. Could you explain that for me?
Yeah. So olaferrtinib, we licensed from a small Chinese company. They retain Asian rights, and we have rights outside of Asia. So while we were completing our phase one study, that company started their phase three study, randomized study, in China. And so they're sponsoring that study, they're running that study, and potentially we can utilize that study if it's successful for a potential US or EU approval down the line. And that's the feedback that we did hear from the FDA, that they'd be amenable for us to potentially utilize that as our pivotal study. So it's really, in my view, a great option for our stockholders for that first line setting while we concentrate our development program in combination with COSI going forward.
Could you give me a little on the protocol or what's your comparator?
Yeah, so that phase 3 study that's ongoing is comparing olifertinib versus a first-generation TKI, so essentially Tarceva or Iressa. Those are the first-gen drugs. Same study design that was utilized by Tagrisso for their approval, same controls. It's a blinded study. The primary endpoint is progression-free survival. It's a well-powered study. It's the correct study design to utilize for an approval in this indication. It's just ongoing only in China, which is obviously perfect for our partner, for their plans. But again, we did speak with the FDA about utilizing it for our own. And what we learned was because this specific indication, EGFR mutation positive non-small cell lung cancer, has a much higher incidence in Asians, the FDA has the flexibility to utilize an Asian study for U.S. decision making. Now, we may have to do some further work on bridging the dose. We don't expect a difference in dose, but we may have to show that. But that's much better than having to run a whole nother phase 3 study for approval. So it's a real benefit for us and our stockholders if that study succeeds and we can then take it forward towards what's left to do for an approval.
Yeah, as I recall from Iressa, the first approval might have been in Japan. Okay, so you have some data. Obviously, your partner is generating data. What can you tell me about the adverse event profile that you say, okay, this is going to compete? This is going to be good.
Yeah, it was very well tolerated. And the typical TKI side effects that you see at rates of 40 or 50% with the other third generation EGFR inhibitor, we're seeing at more like rates of 20%. But again, the real difference is those warnings of precautions that Tagrisso has, interstitial lung disease, cardiomyopathy, QTC prolongation. We haven't seen any of that. So really that's the potential differentiation of our drug. It's differentiating in competition with potentially Tagrisso. But it's also differentiating where we could potentially combine with our anti-PD-L1 where Tagrisso couldn't. Interstitial lung disease prevented Tagrisso from combining with their anti-PD-L1. We've never seen it. We don't expect it's going to be an issue for us. So that's the opportunity we have that may be just for us to exploit.
So if you go with a combination, you'll bring that work back in-house?
That's correct. We want to spend our stockholder money on developing cosibelimab with olifertinib, and we want to concentrate on the unmet medical need of those patients that were treated with Tagrisso and relapsed on Tagrisso, where they have no identifiable mutation after relapsing that can lead to a targeted therapy or a clinical trial. Essentially, 60% of patients have no identifiable mutation, and so they just receive platinum chemotherapy after that. And I know we can do much better for these patients than just chemo alone. So that's where I think IO plus an EGFR inhibitor, so that you still have the kinase inhibition, could be very interesting for these patients. You can still get through the blood-brain barrier and treat the brain mets that these patients largely have in the second-line setting. And I think that doublet or potentially a triplet with chemo could be very interesting. And again, it's an unmet medical need. So the regulatory strategy is very clear and simple and should be an accelerated timeline.
I failed to ask the wrap-up question on the phase 3 being run by your partner. When do we expect a readout on that?
Yeah, good question. They're still enrolling, and we're expecting data sometime in 2024.
Okay. Now, in wrapping up, you described your licensing strategy. So I have to ask, for these two leads that we've been discussing, what's the status of the IP?
Yep, so very strong IP. What you want to see is composition of matter patents. We have composition of matter issued on both of our lead programs, cosibelimab, which we licensed from Dana-Farber. We actually improved the sequences we received and have our own IP composition that protects cosibelimab that goes out to 2038 in the U.S. We have a comparable patent that will be issued in the EU, similar to about 2037 or 2038. So very well protected with a long timeline. Olifertinib goes out to 2034 with its composition of matter patent. So again, very well protected, both of these products with the composition of matter patents that you want to see.
Got it. Okay. And the last question, as always, is for the investors and the bankers. So to be crass, sir, what kind of runway are we looking at? And what sort of conversations would you like to have in a couple of months with JP Morgan?
Yep. So we have cash that takes us through the BLA submission for cosibelimab into next year. But obviously, we will need to raise more cash in order to reach the launch of cosibelimab. And so I think we can watch the market and make the right decision for us. I think looking at ways of raising money that wouldn't be dilutive to stockholders would be our first preference, things like a structured debt transaction. And so we're going to explore that. Also, we are actively talking with potential partners for our programs. For example, cosibelimab in Europe, those partnerships I would expect to come with a meaningful upfront payment. And so that reduces the need for any capital raising that we'd have to do. So obviously that's a priority for us, particularly in these market conditions, is to find an appropriate partner for Cosibelimab in territories outside the U.S.
All right. And there we have it, ladies and gentlemen. That is a wrap. My guest today has been James Oliviero. He is the president and CEO of Checkpoint Therapeutics. James, thank you for bravely making it through this. I hope you can take the rest of the day off.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this week's Benchtop Bios. I hope that this episode will serve as yet another data point to guide you in your investment strategies. If you wish to hear more of LifeSci's Benchtop Bios, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or Google. Also, if there's a company or a particular executive you'd like to get to know, I do take requests. Please send those to ncanavan@lifesciadvisors.com. Until next week, then, goodbye, or for that matter, good sell, whatever boosts your portfolio.